Martha Stewart is, could we call her America's tastemaker? Her fans think she can do anything beautifully. Even people who profess not to like her own her books and cook her recipes. She has a new book called Martha's Entertaining, A Year of Celebration, sort of like her first book almost 30 years ago, which was called Entertaining.
The first book really was kind of an entertaining textbook for the homemaker. I couldn't find a good book about entertaining in 1982, and neither could my friends, so I decided to write it. At the time, I was a caterer.
One of the reviews says, caterer Martha Stewart, and then goes on to describe
right,
the
and I was catering lots and lots of parties, so we photographed the most interesting of the parties. This book is very different because these were all my own personal parties and events that I had at my own home or my weekend home out in East Hampton or up in Maine at my summer house.
Now, the pictures are, as you say, are taken in your very extraordinary homes, and you serve beautiful food on amazing china, beautiful flatware, and all the wonderful glass. How are we meant to think about this book? I mean, this is obviously not the homemaker kind of book.
Well, in a way it is, because what I did in this book was try to capture sort of the essence of what we would all like to do when we entertain, which was make wonderful food from really good recipes, set a pretty table or a beautiful buffet, make flower arrangements, cut from our own gardens. It's kind of a dreamscape in a way, but there are many, many practical and interesting and inspiring kinds of moments throughout the book that I think will enable people to have a pretty Easter, have a wonderful 4th of July, have a inspiring Christmas.
I must say that my first run through the book, I was thinking some people would look at this book and decide that if this is what a Christmas party should look like, and spend the holiday under the bed.
Oh, no. That's not what it's meant to do at all. It's just I'd make the Christmas cookies that are in the book because they're really cute. And I certainly would make a croquembouche.
The Noah's Ark, Noah's Ark cookies.
Yes,
those
aren't
wonderful.
They great? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really great.
Now, when you decorate for Christmas, you can see in the background of all the pictures that there are Christmas trees everywhere and wreaths in every window, and it's incredibly beautiful. I understand you keep all your Christmas decorations in the basement of the farm at Bedford?
Yeah, we have a very organized basement. You would love it down there. I don't know if you're an archivist at all, but it's all organized in those plastic tubs on a big floor-to-ceiling shelves. So we know where everything is. We create Christmas. That's one of our big things every year for television, for the magazine. And so I'm always adding to my collections of stuff. and it's a lot of fun to this year. Oh, I'm doing a whole new thing for the new grandchild. Baby Jude is having a brown bear Christmas.
Oh, my goodness.
Because we made a whole lot of ornaments in the shape of bears this year. So I think that would be sort of cute for a baby who's about 10 months old, don't you?
I think it would be. Of course it would be. Now, I have to say, though, there's a picture of opening the chapter of a ceramic nativity scene that you have on display. It looks like drabware.
Yes, Wedgwood drabware.
That with a sort of light brown coffee cream color.
You caught that, did you?
I just could not quite believe it when I read the caption.
All right. Should I tell you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a funny story. When I was incarcerated at Alderson in West Virginia for a 5-month term, they had a ceramics class. And in the ceramics class was a storage warehouse room where I found all the molds for an entire large nativity scene. It took me a long time to find each mold, and because I was raised a Catholic, I know the story. I know the characters, right? I know the wise men and the camels and all of that stuff. But it's a big thing. I think there's about 15 pieces, and I was able to purchase enough clay with my monthly stipend, and I forwent. Is that a word? Forwent. I didn't get a lot of other things that I would have liked in that 5-month period because I bought clay instead, and I molded the entire nativity scene. And then I had to figure out how to paint it drab color because there's 6 different colors of paint that you could get. But I managed to fashion a drab color, and it looks just like Wedgwood.
One of the things that I was fascinated about this book was that each chapter begins with an explanation of what the entertainment is, you know, an Easter egg party, a Christmas party, a boat party. And then there is a printed menu, and there are lots of pictures of beautiful table settings and flowers and whatnot. And then in some cases, you include a picture where the table is not been cleared, but all the people have left. So the chairs are like pushed back every sort of way, and the napkins are just crumpled up on the table.
That was the morning after a Burgundy dinner. And I bought that beautiful house in Maine, which had been built by Edsel Ford, by the way. They built a wine cellar right in the stone foundation of the house. It's built right into the granite mountain. And when I bought the house from the second family that owned it, they left their wine cellar for me, which was filled with aging Burgundy. So I was told by an expert, a wine expert friend, he said, boy, you better drink this Burgundy. It's going to go over the hill soon. So we designed a Burgundy dinner. We drank and drank and drank bottles of delicious 85s and 82s. And it was time, and they were good. And we served them with short ribs and beautiful fig and apple tarts. And none of us felt like cleaning up after this elaborate dinner. So and the table actually, I thought, looked kind of interesting. So we left it. And next morning, we photographed it. If you are a careful hostess, though, you would pour a little bit of water into each of the glasses so that the wine doesn't etch the beautiful crystal. Do you
know
that?
Did you remember to do it?
I did.
Of course you did. Well, thank you very much for this.
Okay.
Martha Stewart's newest book, which I believe is book number 75. Could that possibly be right?
Yes, it is.
It's called Martha's Entertaining, A Year of Celebrations. Martha Stewart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's a recipe for Noah's Ark cookies at npr.org, also a picture of that nativity scene. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A few weeks ago, we asked listeners to tell us about their favorite holiday foods. Not conventional dishes, something that's only made this time of year. Something unique to their families or popular where they live. Well, we asked for unique, and we're going to give you one example of what we heard back. Heather McDonald of Manhattan Beach, California, wrote in to introduce us to tomato pudding.
It consists of tomato paste, butter, boiling water, salt, and brown sugar. And then we like to insist that you use Wonder Bread because it's nice and mushy, and it just makes it taste the best.
The first ingredients are cooked together and poured over pieces of the cut-up Wonder Bread, then it's baked in the oven. Heather describes the dish as both sweet and savory.
It does have a taste of tomato to it, but you can also taste the sugars, and then due to the bread, it also has a little bit of a pudding feel to it. It is something that 100% makes my mouth water as soon as I start to think of it.
And yet she is not quite sure how the tradition got started.
I know that it was passed down through my father's side of the family, and I know that he has some Canadian roots. We feel like it may come from there. I only know of one other person that has ever heard of tomato pudding in my whole life.
Heather McDonald admits this rather unique concoction may not sound very good to eat, but insists that descriptions do not really do tomato pudding justice.
It's one of those things that you have to taste it to believe it. And initially, it does sound rather disgusting. I actually cannot stand tomatoes, so it's kind of humorous that I actually look forward to tomato pudding twice a year.
Okay, so there you have it. And maybe you're going to be looking forward to tomato pudding soon, because you can find photos as well as the recipe for the pudding and other holiday treats at npr.org. Coca-Cola is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year, which sounds impressive, until you consider a family in New York City that is quietly toasting 140 years in the soft drink business. White Rock is the beverage company. NPR's Joel Rose sampled some of the time-tested sodas and sent along this report.
White Rock may not be a household name today, but it used to be, and so is the girl on the bottle.
It's Psyche, the girl from the White Rock label.
You mean the girl from eight White Rock labels. Haven't you heard?
The Greek goddess Psyche has appeared on millions of bottles and cans of White Rock sparkling water, tonic water, and ginger ale. And on every one, she is topless, gazing at her own reflection in a crystal clear pool of water. White Rock president Larry Bodkin says there was nothing lewd or suggestive about that Psyche logo when it debuted around the turn of the 20th century.
In those days, a bare breast was like almost the ultimate sign of purity.
The girl with wings called Psyche tells you the flavor's fine.
So look for me on every label of the sparkling White Rock line.
White Rock was founded in Waukesha, Wisconsin in 1871 and moved its headquarters to New York 35 years later. By 1930, the company dominated the U.S. sparkling water business with a market share of 90%, according to Time magazine.
It was a real upper-class type of an item, like used at the coronation of Queen Victoria, and you know, Charles Lindbergh christened his plane before he flew with it. You know, Gloria Vanderbilt was baptized with it.
The company's products haven't changed too much over the years, and neither has Psyche. She's gotten a little skinnier and a little taller, but she's still naked from the waist up. That's attracted some unwanted attention for White Rock over the years. Mimsy Morgan Bodkin is the daughter of Alfred Morgan Jr., who ran White Rock from the 1920s to the 1970s.
Of course, I always got a lot of ribbing at school about the girl on the bottle. You know, people kept asking me. I got sick of it. I said, it was not me on the bottle, it's my mother.
At its height, White Rock employed hundreds of people, mostly at its factory in Brooklyn. Bob Wadiska joined White Rock as a salesman in the 1950s and never left.
When I started, there were so many small independent beverage companies. Every borough had two or three. And then, you know, Pepsi and Coke sort of took over, like in so many industries. And fortunately, we're still one of the very few that's left. We're still here.
Though just barely. White Rock fell on hard times in the 1980s. Today it has just a dozen employees. About half of them work at a modest mid-rise office building near LaGuardia Airport in Queens. So which one is that?
That was the seltzer, sparkling seltzer, which is probably the item that we sell more than anything of these days.
Larry Bodkin says his family could have sold White Rock many times, and maybe should have. But having come this far, Bodkin hopes the brand can cash in on the growing demand for all things artisanal and old-fashioned.
We've been around, but we're healthy and growing. It's kind of a combination of factors, and nobody can replicate our history. I mean, even Coke and Pepsi, I think they go back to the 1890s, you know, not as old as we are, so it's legitimate. You know, we are the oldest beverage company.
If you need proof, you could even ask Santa Claus. St. Nick appeared in holiday ads for White Rock throughout the teens and 20s, years before he went to work for Coca-Cola. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
And you can see those original White Rock ads and more at NPR.org.
In hard times, comfort food can be reassuring. So perhaps that's why one of the latest foodie trends shouldn't be much of a surprise. Gourmet meatballs, anyone? Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf takes note.
If you live in New York City, you've seen this coming. The meatball shop opened last year in the Lower East Side and has been so popular, there are now three of them offering meatballs with your choice of sauce. Uptown is an Italian restaurant called Polpette, translation, meatball. A few weeks ago, the Meatball Factory opened near Gramercy Park. There's even a bartender, excuse me, mixologist, in New York who makes what he calls a meatball cocktail. It involves frying spicy sausages, then draining the fat into Irish whiskey. At the recent New York Wine and Food Festival, the Meatball Madness competition was sold out. The Judges' Choice Award went to the Little Owl Restaurant's Gravy Meatball Slider, a recipe from the owner's grandmother. They sell more than 1,000 a week. The madness is spreading. Meatballs are served with butter and thyme in Chicago and made of foie gras in Minneapolis. L.A.'s Great Balls on Tires meatball truck urges patrons to join the Reballution. Meatballs are now on the menu at Applebee's and neighborhood delis. And in the nation's capital, James Beard Award-winning chef Michel Richard, known for sophisticated French cuisine, has just opened a restaurant called Meatballs. Do they even have meatballs in France? Americans think of meatballs perched on top of spaghetti, all covered in cheese. But meatballs are universal. Spanish albondigas are popular tapas, Greek keftedes are made with lamb and mint, and Japanese sukune use chicken and ginger. Thai, Chinese, Vietnamese, Moroccan, and Indian cuisines all feature spherical meats. And let us not forget the Swedish meatball. Variations on these themes are played out in the new meatballeries. The Meatball Madness winners included a goat curry ball and a rabbit ball. There are meatballs made with lean meats, such as bison and ostrich. There are jambalaya balls and turducken balls. There are even vegetarian meatballs, whatever that means. And if you want to make balls at home, at least 6 new books have been published in just the last 2 months focusing on the food orbs. Why meatballs? They're affordable and familiar. They're a happy food in hard times. To quote from the new Meatball Shop cookbook, meatballs are the ultimate cure-all for anything that ails you.
Bonnie Wolf is working on a book about the foods of Maryland's Eastern Shore. This is NPR News.